Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Very excited to have this week's guest on, someone whose work I've been a big fan of for a long, long time, and you probably have too. A member of a little rock band you may have heard of called The Rolling Stones. He's the former original bassist for The Stones, Bill Wyman. Bill, really great to have you on. Thanks for being on the show.
Pleasure. Thank you.
About the film, it's interesting. It's kind of ironic that you have a doc out on your life, given that you've been known as the quiet one. Why did you decide to put yourself out there at this point in your life and sort of expose yourself more than you've done in the past?
I've been asked for years to do a documentary of my life because they knew I had an archive and that I collected and I had diaries and et cetera, et cetera. To do a documentary on my life for TV and all that, and I always said no and cancelled and thought it was too much trouble. And then finally, I met with some people and we decided to do it as a movie so we could get more information into it, because my life has been so varied and so interesting and different than your average person that and really interesting that it needed a bit more time to get as much in as possible, although we had to leave out miles of stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because that goes to a quote that I saw of yours where you said, "I spent an entire lifetime cultivating my interest in music, photography, archaeology, history, sports, love of nature, and collecting artifacts and my archive." So I'm wondering, you know, you grew up blue collar, not a lot of money, become a famous musician, and obviously you have money from that. If you weren't this musician and successful musician, would you still have had those interests and been able to cultivate them? I guess it's a nature nurture question. Or if you were still a blue collar guy, do you think you would have gone into those other areas of interest?
Well, I asked, Knopfler was asked to comment on me for the film, although we didn't use his comment in the film, as we did many people, and we didn't other people.
I'm sorry, who was that? I didn't hear you.
Mark Knopfler.
Okay, yeah.
You know, Dire Straits.
Yeah, big fan, yeah.
Now he's solo. He's a great friend, and he knows me intimately. He knows that I collect things, and I'm involved in history and all that. And he said if Bill Wyman hadn't ever been the bass player of the Rolling Stones, he would probably now be a curator at the British Museum.
Well, you would have had a lot in common with my wife. She's a curator as well. So, so this is in you. This is just who you are, huh?
Over the years, many people asked me if I hadn't been a Rolling Stone or a musician, what would I have probably been? And I said, I always thought I'd be either work in a museum or in a library, be a librarian or something, because I love cataloguing things, I love history, I'm OCD, so I love getting things sorted and having them all correct. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why it's great to have my archive and write a diary every day and things like that.
And what is it, what does that do for you? You're obviously a very creative person, but what do those interests do for you? What does history do for you? What does art do for you? Does it just immerse you into those worlds and help you disconnect from the real world? Or what does it bring you?
I was always interested in ancient cultures. When I used to tour with a band, there were times when you were in a hotel room with nothing to do and you couldn't go out or anything, and so I'd read books on ancient cultures. I'd read about the Aztecs, the Incas, the Toltecs, the Egyptians, the Norse gods, you know, the Norse sagas, the Aborigines, all kinds of early cultures, Phoenicians, the Assyrians, the Greeks, and I would learn all that stuff because I loved all that kind of stuff. And with writing a diary and keeping records of happenings, it helped me when I wrote books and when I collected things. And then when I got into archaeology, which I did for 20 years, which is not in the film, of course, because there was no room.
You know, my mom is a first-generation Italian in America. But when she was like 16, she really kind of had to stop going to school to help with the rate of her mom was sick. Her dad passed away. And I think she always felt like she kind of got screwed out of a proper education. And I know your dad pulled you out of school when you were young and had you go to work, I believe, for a bookie. And, you know, you came from a not well-off family. Do you feel like, in some ways, this pursuit of knowledge and passion for it is sort of making up for that education that you probably should have had?
Well, what happened was I just didn't get on with my father. So I ended up living with my grandmother, and I lived with her throughout the war, during the bombing and everything. And she looked after me and my schooling. She got me into piano lessons. She got me into the church choir. She also got me into collecting things. She started to teach me to collect stamps, coins, cigarette cards, which you call bubblegum cards, I think, or baseball cards, and all kinds of things like that. And then she'd read me all the English literature, and she was fantastic. And she really taught me. She taught me maths, which is my best subject. And I learned so much from her, which took me forward and made me more and more interested in collecting things. Mm-hmm. And of course, when I got married in 1959, and then I had a son in 62, just before the Stones, I decided when I was in the band that I'd collect a few things just to show my son that I was in a band once, and we made a record and we were on the
We were in a band that did that kind of made yeah, but, that's hilarious.
Well, we didn't know how long it'd last because we were playing commercial music at the time. We were playing blues and it wasn't commercial and we weren't getting a record deals and things. And so I thought I better keep a few things so he'd know, just like my dad did, because my dad played football and got a schoolboys cup final medal, which he gave to me, it was like his treasure, the only thing he ever got. And I thought, well, I should keep a few things for my son. But then, of course, as my son grew up and the band carried on, my son wasn't the slightest bit interested because he lived through it, and I just carried on collecting, and that's how the archive began, really. And then once it began, then I carry on.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I've been working in TV for a while. I've worked on The Daily Show, the Colbert Report. I work on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert on CBS. So my son, like your son, has kind of been around it. So I don't think they get phased. Like one day I go, hey, Alex, Bruce Springsteen's playing on the show. You want to come over? He's like, nah, I'm going out with my friends. Like, you know what I mean? I think they just get kind of like numb to it a little bit or something, you know?
I know. Yeah. Well, Stephen used to come on tour with us when he was young, you know, right the way through my son's career. He used to come on tour when he was off school, when he had holidays or something. Mm. But, you know, it didn't faze him. He just enjoyed it and then got back to normal life, really.
Yeah.
And that's the way my daughters are. You know, I've got three beautiful daughters now with my marriage to my American wife, who comes from Los Angeles originally, and we've been married 26 years. I've got three beautiful daughters. They've all got their own lives, you know. They know Dad's been in a big band. They know he's been in another band as well called the Rhythm Kings. They know that I've written books and I've had restaurants and I do photo exhibitions, etc., etc. And I do archaeology and I do charity sport. They know all that, and so it's just normal bread and butter to them. So it doesn't surprise them or interest them, really.
Well, I think that's good for somebody that's at that level like you are. You know, I feel like you probably want to just, you don't, I mean, it's great having people throw themselves at you and scream for you and all that good stuff when you're on the road, but I imagine you just want to be a regular person when you're at the house.
Well, exactly, yeah, and just try to live a normal life, and that's what we do.
Yeah.
And bless them, they're great girls, they're well-behaved. That's my son, he's from the 60s, who was 8 months old when I joined the band. You know, so I had responsibilities at home, and that's what probably kept me straight and on the straight and narrow and kept me quiet, as they say. As Charlie was also married at the same time, and he had a daughter, so we had responsibilities. So you got the rhythm section behaving themselves and going home where they had responsibilities, when the other guys were fly-by-nights, you know, and having fun in the clubs in London or whatever and getting stoned or drunk or whatever they did.
Yeah. Would you and Charlie try to get them to pull back on that and try to talk them back a little bit, or was it just, you know, there's no talking to those guys?
That, that wasn't our responsibility. Our responsibility is we're looking after our families at home, really. No, I mean, it was fun. It was very, very funny to see things go on. And of course, in the early 60s and touring and all that, I always shared rooms with Brian. And Brian was always out there, you know, at the clubs. And we used to go out and find the girls when Mick and Keith were writing songs in the hotel, etc. And so there was always great things going on. And nobody sort of said, you mustn't do this or you mustn't do that. You know, we were all free persons. We all chose what to wear. We didn't have an image worked out or anything. We just were our normal selves. And that's the way the band was, and that's why we were individually known by the public.
Yeah. You talked about Mick and Keith writing. Just out of curiosity, because I'm really fascinated in the process of making music, because I'm not musically talented at all, and I'm amazed. And you do have a band currently called the Rhythm Kings, which people should know about. But I'm fascinated how you guys can make music. You can hear those sounds, put them together, and then words. What was the process generally like with the Stones? Were you coming in with ideas and working off of your ideas and Charlie's ideas, or was it pretty much Mick and Keith? And if it was just Mick and Keith, were you then like putting in your spin on it on the bass? Like, how would that work generally?
Well, on odd occasions, Mick would come in with a basic song idea. Keith would come in with a riff. And mess around on a riff, and then Charlie and me would add to it, and then whoever was the other guitar player, whether it was Ronnie or Brian or Mick Taylor, we'd suddenly work on it, and over a period of time, in amongst doing five or six ideas like that, you'd end up with a basic track, and then Mick would sort of sing along, you know, mumbling and all that, and then he'd sit down and at home and write lyrics for it, and then they'd finish the song off. So it was kind of, a lot of it was invented in the studios from a basic idea from Keith or a bit more of a song from Mick. But Keith didn't come in very often with a kind of a song. He came in with riffs and ideas.
Wow, that's amazing.
And it was constructed in the studio. That's the way it was, and over a period of time. And then I'd add my bit, Charlie would add his bits, and so on.
Right, right. It really was very collaborative. And was there a song or particular songs that ended up being, you know, hits, and God knows you have a million of them, hits, but do you remember a song or two where you're like, you guys weren't getting it, or you didn't think you could get it, and then you finally broke through and got the song that you wanted? I would imagine, you know, I'm a comedian, there's some jokes like, I know this is a great joke, but you can't really get it to work. Did that happen, but then the song turned out to be a great song?
Well, on occasions, of course, yeah. That's what I was saying. You know, sometimes they built up over a period of a week or something, on and off in between other ideas that you worked on. So you'd keep coming back to that basic idea and seeing if you could improve on it.
Right.
And eventually something would be complete. But, it was just a slow process. And sometimes me, being OCD and being very logical, used to find it quite boring sometimes. And Mick Taylor found it incredibly boring. And in the end, he left because he was bored and he couldn't deal with it, you know. So it was a tough one. But that's the way it was worked. And that's the way it worked, and it became successful that way, so you had to accept it.
You know, you mentioned that you guys were doing a lot of rhythm and blues early on.
Blues, pure blues. We started with pure blues. We just did Muddy Waters stuff.
And so how did you guys decide to move into rock and roll? Was that something that just naturally happened, or were you kind of pushed in that direction by people on your team, managers or whatever?
It's very well documented. We were a blues band in a club, in clubs,
right.
Young Commercial. So we went and made our first recordings, and they were all rejected by the record companies because they were uncommercial. And we continued. And then, when we started to make records and started to be partly successful, we moved into the ballrooms out of the clubs, and we had to play more up-tempo things. So we played more R&B stuff. And then years later, we were going into theatres where we had to do it once again, play more up-tempo stuff, and then we had to go into studios. We had to go into stadiums. And that's when it became rock and roll. And, you know, it was a progression, and you had to do it because you were dealing with different types of audiences.
Hmm. So I know Ray Charles is somebody that is a big influence and an idol of yours. And what was it about Ray Charles that grabbed you? And I believe you had a chance to play for him, but turned that down. Do I have that right? If so, I was wondering why.
Yeah, it's in the film. When I talk about Ray Charles being my favorite artist of the 20th century. I mean, I had lots of favorites, but he was the top. I mean, I was crazy about Fats Waller, Chuck Berry, Beatles, Elvis, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Billie Holiday. You know, I had so many, but Ray Charles stood out above them all, and he's the only person I ever saw in concert where the audience were reduced to tears, a big audience of 4,000 people, when he was just singing Georgia on My Mind by himself. The piano, and then going backstage, being invited backstage by him and meeting him, and sitting and talking to my idol for half an hour was extraordinary. And then he said, "Would you like to play on my next album?" And I said, "Mr. Charles, I'm just not good enough." I felt that he was far a superior musician than I would ever be, in the same way that when I first met the great artist Marc Chagall in South of France, which is also in the film, that he always referred to me as an equal. And Jimmy Baldwin, the black writer, the same thing. They think of you as a fellow artist. And I can't relate to that because, for me, they're way up above me. I'm just a bass player from South London, you know, who played in a good band. And they are like gods to me, and I can't relate that I'm on the same level as them. And that's why I said to Ray Charles, I'm not good enough to play on your next. And I wasn't jiving. I mean, it's just the way I felt.
So how was it to look back on your life through this documentary? And did you walk away looking at things, certain parts of your life differently than the way you were looking at it before you did the documentary?
Well, it was unfortunate because when I started doing it, we did quite a lot of it, and then I was diagnosed with prostate cancer out of the blue, and I had to stop with the film and do like 2 years of medication and all that, and taking steroids and all that kind of stuff. My face got very puffy, and I couldn't film anymore because I didn't look the same. So I had to wait until I got recovered and back to normal before we could finish the film. So it took a longer period than we thought. And that was, you know, just a necessity. But I'm very proud of it. I love what we did. I know it only shows segments of my life, whereas there's a lot more that could have been shown, but there was just no room. Everything's reduced to a minimum, really, although there's bits of home movies in there, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm very proud of it, and I'm very happy about it. But, I mean, we could do version 2 or version 3 or version 4, you know. There's so much stuff.
Well, I hope you do, because this opened my eyes. I had no idea that you were such a worldly gentleman that had all these interests, and it's just been a really interesting, it's a really interesting film. People should see it. It's called The Quiet One. It's out now. Your band, The Rhythm Kings, is out there. And I can't tell you what a treat it's been to have you on and really get to know you more. This is the reason I do my show. And so folks should go see the film. Or maybe I'll run into you at a library. Maybe you'll be a librarian for a while. It sounds like that's something you haven't tried yet, right?
So. Or a museum curator.
All right, Bill Wyman, thanks for being on, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.